Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, and welcome back to another edition of New Books in Systems and Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Tom Scholt, from the University of British Columbia. International and transnational historiography has given us vivid glimpses of the development and impact of cybernetics on a national scale in such countries as the Soviet Union, Chile, and of course in the US and Great Britain, where the field initially began to coalesce. Now, Xiao Liu's Information Fantasies, Precarious Mediation in Post-Socialist China, out from University of Minnesota Press in 2019, makes a massive contribution to the field by opening up a fascinating new vista for scholars of cybernetics, film studies, literature, media studies, science and technology studies, and beyond. Liu's meticulously researched and crisply written book takes us from the heady days of China's Qigong craze and notions of the human body as a transparent medium through which information waves could pass, through investment and research into a theory of metasynthetic wisdom that could lead to a global human-machine intelligent system, the evolution of expert systems to provide knowledge and guidance in the absence of human experts, the novel deployment of Ross Ashby's theory of ultra-stability to describe China's supposed resistance to modernization, information aesthetics within a new rising tide of advertising and market activity, and much, much more. All of this combines to reveal a China after Mao vigorously employing the theoretical tools of cybernetics to not only reconfigure its socio-political image on a national scale, but to actually craft a new post-socialist subjectivity at the scale of the individual citizen. Illustrating the profound impacts of and reactions to these efforts through provocative samplings from Chinese literature, film, and popular culture writ large, Liu manages, in the words of Oxford's Margaret Hillenbrand, to, quote, entirely reconfigure our understanding of the media landscape in 1980s China, end quote. And so, without any further ado, let's turn to my interview with Xiao Liu. Xiao Liu, welcome to New Books in Systems and Cybernetics. It's such a pleasure to have you here to talk about this really, really exciting book that gives us a glimpse into a world that, at least from my experience, has been not as accessible to readers in English until you've brought this amazing book forward. So congratulations on this book, first of all.
Thank you very much. Thank you for this invitation.
Yeah, my pleasure. It's great to have you here. So can we start off as we normally do on this channel with you telling us a little bit about yourself, your academic background, your trajectory, and how you came to an engagement with cybernetics and systems theory inside the wider scope of the sociocultural analysis that you do?
Yes, sure. I'm a professor at McGill University. My research mainly focuses on media and technology in China. So how did I come to working on this book project, which focuses on the 1980s China in relation to the source of information fantasies I called in the book? So I guess my research interest in information and media technology can be traced back to my graduate school years at UC Berkeley. When I entered the graduate program there, my major training and research interest was in literary and cultural studies. Yet any sensitive cultural studies scholar at that time would notice that the landscape of contemporary literature and culture were quickly shifting with media and information technologies, such as internet, such as digital technology. So this was the case, of course, in North America, but particularly in China. So there's a particular instance that directly led me to this interesting field in information technology and media study is that around the new year of 2006, a young man named Hu Ge, he made a parody video of the famous Chinese director Chiang Kai-shek's new movie, The Promise. So as a movie fan, he was quite disappointed with the movie, so he made a mockery video, which quickly went viral among Chinese netizens. So the video was actually made from all the footages from parodied DVD and other found footages of Chinese TV programs. So this incident was actually quite fascinating to me as a culture scholar for several reasons. So on the one hand, the video is totally made of pastiches. And it could be a textbook example of all these kind of like, you know, postmodern culture theories and critique that every humanities scholar, every humanities student would read in graduate school. But on the other hand, it also raised a lot of questions and issues, which I felt cannot be solved with the kind of like approaches of cultural studies and film study I was familiar with at that moment. So, for example, the video, how it addressed the audience is very unique because, you know, it often comes with kind of like blurry images and no definition and also reduced the sound effects. And people always watch it when they're multitasking, you know, on a digital device or like commuting on buses or trains. So the mode of spectatorship is very different from the kind of like theatrical release. And we know that kind of like theatrical mode is kind of like, you know, the very base for a lot of established methods of a film critique, such as a parodic theory. So to me, the question is how to understand the spectatorship of the small mobile screen media and the kind of like, you know, bodily experience associated with it. So I was quite fascinated with these questions and, you know, from that point on, try to understand how information technologies were reshaping the cultural practice and cultural industries. So this episode seems quite far flung from the kind of like, you know, the topics of this podcast, but I think that explains my entry point, which is that my interest in cybernetic system theory as a culture media scholar really lies in the ways they impacted culture practices, how they impacted the kind of like, you know, media practice, how they offer the vision to understand the sensory experience, the bodily experience in the age of ubiquitous sensors, actuators, and screens. So around about at the same time, if you recall, a mobile smartphone started to take an increasingly important role in everyday life. So if you look at the back this past decade, you may realize how much the kind of like, you know, always connectedness, always online, become a common status for most people. This is even more the case for many Chinese people. There was a very interesting book that just came out last year called Super Sticky WeChat and Chinese Society. So the authors of this book, they show that how Chinese people's everyday life, from grocery shopping to interpersonal communication, even to various engagements with government administrations, become mediated through this mega platform called WeChat. So as a scholar, I wanted to make sense of these rapid changes, you know, how this technology mediated and reshaped human connections, and how to understand this 24/7 temporality of connectedness and information circuits. So you can see this personal experience lead me to think about the impact of information technologies and social and cultural practice. So then the question is that, and why in the book I actually go back to the 1970s and 1980s to tell the story of China, right? So this study with literary encounter in the East Asian Library at UC Berkeley. So in a sunny California afternoon, I went to the library. When browsing, I rarely visit a section of old Chinese journals. I found in the most reputable intellectual journal, there was a series, a selected translation of Alvin Toffler's then newly published 1980 book, The Third Wave. So to people who are not so familiar with Toffler's work, he was recognized, he was known as a guru who disseminated the futurist vision of a coming information society. He painted a rosy picture of a future society where all sorts of social problems would be solved by information technology. People would have the flexibility of deciding where and when to work. So any kind of like strenuous labor we usually associate with factual work, factual labor, would be replaced by just a few hits on the keyboard. So Toffler's rosy picture sounded uncannily familiar to me, especially at a moment when you have all sorts of like Silicon Valley legends continued to promise technology solution to everything. So it was quite an illuminating moment for me to see this discourse and imaginations around information technology actually hadn't changed so much through the decades, through the last few decades. So back to Toffler, I later discovered that he was actually quite popular in China. He visited China in person twice in the 1980s. The second time he was received by Zhao Ziyang, the then head of the party. His writing was also assigned as study materials for the party culture. So the Chinese translation of the book of his book, The Third Wave, instantly became a bestseller in 1980s China. So why Toffler attracted such intense attention? So I started to poke around and dig into archives and found that the interest in Toffler was actually just the tip of an iceberg. So the whole Chinese society in the 1980s post-Mao China was quite actually taken by all sorts of fantasies with what information technology can do. People not only believed in the power of information technology, but also adopted information theory, cybernetics, and system theory to explain all sorts of social and cultural phenomena. So reading these writings, reading these people's adoption, the use of cybernetics to explain everything from literature, aesthetics, to Chinese history and society, prompted me to learn more about the history of cybernetics. So I can go into more details, but you can see my encounter with cybernetics actually took place in this hyper-mediated space. Cybernetics to me become kind of like, very crucial component or a very important lineage to understand, to investigate into the intellectual history and, the politics of knowledge production. So history is very important in this project because it provides reference to understand the the discourses, the current discourse, and you know the changes, you know, of our days that we usually associate with information technology. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Great. Thank you so much. So you've already talked a bit about the notion of information fantasies, because I one of the things I like to do on this program sometimes is if there's a title of a book that's got a lot of terminology in it to sort of unpack, even what might seem to be obvious words for people, I sometimes find there's a lot of things lurking inside. So you've already spoken a bit about information fantasies and that there was a kind of a technological optimism spawned by Toffler's work, the reception to Toffler's work in China and some other stuff as well. Can you talk a little bit about mediation? The subtitle of the book is fascinating phrase, precarious mediation in post-socialist China. There's a lot to chew on there. So can you talk a little bit about mediation as you see it, as it's conceptualized by some of the key players in the book, and then tell us a little bit about what is the precarious nature of the type of mediation that you're exploring in post-Mao China?
Yeah, so the choice of using the word mediation instead of media is actually quite deliberate on my part. This is for several reasons. You know, I have made this choice for several reasons. Because the notion of media, you know, come with a lot of kind of, you know, historical baggage of understanding there. So in the first place, you know, media, you know, often refers to, you know, TV, radio, you know, this type of institutionalized mass media that we are familiar with. They usually associated with a certain delivery modes or business model that we think we all know, right? And this notion of media to me is quite restrictive. It is not broad enough to cover to define or to convey the kind of like, you know, phenomenon I discussed in this book. And the second reason is that, you know, the notion of media, you know, common understanding of media, is that it often associated with technological objects. So, you know, we always understand media, you know, associated with kind of like, you know, technical, in terms of technical objects, you know. And this way, I think it always ends up reinforcing kind of like, you know, a fetish with this, you know, technological objects, right? So, you know, at our time, you know, we can see technology objects is always interested with the power to transform everything to induce all kinds of like, you know, social transformations. So you can still feel this kind of like, you know, technology a fetish with these legends of Silicon Valley's. And it's still quite appealing and powerful to a lot of people. And I feel like, you know, it's exactly this kind of like fetish that I have to talk to in this project, right? Mm-hmm. And then, so the reason is that it's related to the recent development in media studies. Because in the past decades, the media studies, the field of media study has expanded to include all kinds of like, you know, objects that were not usually regarded as media, such as, you know, for example, people write about, you know, archives, write about the water and, you know, air, you know, or, you know, environmental elemental media. So, you know, images, writing, and, you know, even like doors, mirrors, these kind of things were not associated with, were not understood as media. So I think, you know, this kind of like an expansion of the purview of media study really raised the question, you know, ontological question about what is a media, right? So I think, you know, it's occasion to seriously think about the, you know, what makes media. So one example that I begin with my book is a photo of Qigong practitioner assembly that was taken in Beijing. So in this photo, these Qigong practitioners, you can see, they were wearing a household cooking pot on their head, mm-hmm. right?
The information pot, yeah?
Yes, exactly. They were dubbed that, they were dubbed information pots because they were expected to receive information from the outer space. So I think this is a very interesting example to show, cooking pot, it's not usually regarded as kind of like, communication tool. It's not regarded as a media. But in this context, they actually produce and facilitates new relations between the human body and the so-called information environment, right? So I think this transformation of a pot into media actually destabilizes a fixed conventional understanding of a media and raises a question about, what does media do, right? Mm. So I think, what's important here is really, what kind of relationship is generated through this process of mediation. So mediation, we know it is come from a kind of philosophical tradition. It's less about objects, but more about the kind of the processes and for relations. So I think, it is actually deals with kind of context and conflicts and then negotiation between different realms and agents and objects. So I think in this instance, it's actually very helpful for us to understand the 1980s China context I'm focusing on, because, you can see if you look at the kind of all these kind of writings and discourse from, official ideology to the intellectual discourse, to the popular culture, they do not necessarily form a coherent whole. They often come with, all kinds of contradictions with each other. So, mediation is a very good term to capture the kind of very complicated negotiation between different social forces, agents between, human subjects and, technology in that context. So that's why mediation is a better choice for me in this project.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's great. And you have raised an issue that seems to me very central, at least in my reading of the book, this relationship between the individual and the information environment. And in terms of what, the nature of the interface, what is the interface? You even early in the book, you mention Mark Hansen's book, New Philosophy for New Media, where he speaks more about the human being as a medium, in a sense, that the human being is empowered as a converter of polymorphous digital data, able to actualize singular experience, and that the human is a kind of apparatus that renders information perceptible. And so exactly where the boundary is of media and what is the system, the web of all that is really crucial. And this interface and the loops between the individual and the so-called information environment seem really critical to what's on the minds of the theorists, the politicians, the writers, the scholars during this period.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And can you say something about the precarious nature of this mediation, and then maybe talk a little bit about what of how you intend the term post-socialist China, which for people that have not studied China closely, I think they will find the term post-socialist China puzzling in itself because of this notion of, of China as a communist country, et cetera. And obviously, there are things that have remained the same. But it's a very different time that we move into following Mao. So can you say a little bit about post-socialist China and the meaning of that term, and what then makes mediation in that particular milieu at that particular historical moment so precarious, as you nod to in the title?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, sure. Yeah, I think this is, as you point out, this is a key term, in this book. So on a most obvious level, of course, it refers to the, very specific social political environment of post-Mao China. So we know with Mao's death in 1976 and the official end of the Cultural Revolution, So there's a shift in terms of the politics, in terms of the direction of the party. With Deng Xiaoping come to the power, he basically shifted from Mao's class struggle politics to economic development, right? So, as you know, the source of information fantasy I discussed in this book, emerged around this moment when China started its opening door with these economic reforms and you know, with all this kind of like new political climate there. So, but on another level, but also I want to employ the term as kind of like a critical lens to examine the set of like, you know, globally circulated discourse about information society, were in fact closely tied to the Cold War politics of knowledge production. So, specifically, you know, that is with the we call modernization theory, right? So modernization theory were actually growing out of the post-war U.S. liberalism and emerged from the think tank at Harvard, you know, Social Science Research Council and MIT. Basically, they disseminated an image of a liberal and a prosperous capitalist West, especially exemplified by, of course, by the United States, as the goal of development for the rest of the world. So it aimed at providing a kind of like, you know, scheme of industrialization and modernization in non-West and underdeveloped countries. And, you know, there are two pillars of this modernization theory. One is scientism, the other is developmentalism. So it become kind of an ideological weapon for the United States to compete with Soviet Union during the Cold War. So I think, you know, the kind of like information, the discourse of information society was closely tied to this this modernization theory. For example, Daniel Bell, you know, one of the important person which, you know, his book, you know, post-industrial, like coming on post-industrial society was also translated into China in the 1980s, become one of the important texts associated with information age. He basically argued that like technological innovation would become kind of like, you know, major force to drive human society toward the future. And, you know, that was kind of like, you know, very, you know, optimistic post for this the social utopia with associated with this information technology, right? I think put into this lineage, you know, Alvin Toffler's book, you know, Alvin Toffler's argument was not so new at all. He actually simply proposed that information technology alone can transform, you know, nature of work, you know, and the kind of like, you know, alienation of manufacturing labor. So I think technology becomes the sole solution of social problems in this instance. So I think the effect of this discourse can still be felt today. So, you know, we all have this term like, you know, Facebook revolution or Twitter revolution, right? So basically it's kind of like associated technology with these social transformations, right? But this association with of information technology with modernization was actually very powerful in 1980s China. So, yeah. So you can see, you know, the crucial link here between information discourse and the post-socialist politics is very important to understand this politics of technology. So I think, you know, the post-socialism on this level, you know, of course, refers to the specific condition of post-modern China, but it also refers to the kind of like, you know, how this globally circulated discourse and knowledge production is also kind of like, you know, closely tied to this Cold War or remains of Cold War framework of knowledge production that shape us, shape our understanding of, you know, the history. Right.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing, too. Your book is full of really specific examples of Chinese literature and film and television, and how that content, as well as the various forms of media, the various apparatuses that are used, and how they are involved in the process of at least attempting to sort of reinvent the Chinese subject itself, right? The notion of subjecthood from a socialist subject of, say, the Cultural Revolution to the post-socialist subject, which is a different kind of subjectivity, and how the circulation through the system is involved in doing that. And many, many wonderful examples of a bunch of films that I now need to find in my university's library and dig into. I want to jump for a second, jumping a little bit forward, because I want to come back to the way the mediation of the Chinese subject of the post-socialist subject is so central to the book. But speaking of Chinese history and modernization theory and the development of China, I think it's the second chapter, you talk about how some scholars using the systems theoretic notion of the ultra-stable system as a framework to try and describe China's feudal past and what are perceived by these scholars to be barriers to this march towards modernization. Can you say a little bit about that? Because I think that's really, really fascinating from a systems theory point of view.
Right. The scholar who proposed this, using system theory to understand Chinese society and Chinese history, is Jing Guanhao and his wife Liu Qingfeng. So they basically understand the society, they understand Chinese society as kind of a complex system consisting of interacting subsystems. So to them is the economic, the political, and the culture. So the understanding of Chinese society is this the interaction of this subsystem through the kind of a circulation of functional input and output, which together achieve kind of like homeostasis and result in kind of like stability of the whole system, right? But to their understanding, the Chinese society as a system is not only stable, it's ultra stable, in the sense that they always remain certain kind of like stability. That's the explanation for why Chinese society, despite all the change, despite all these kind of like variables in history, it's still stuck in kind of like remains of feudalist system. That's the argument, right? So the central question is that why did feudalism persist in China? So the answer was that an ultra-stable system. But but China, which kind of like regarded as stagnant, and about China from progressing into this modern age. So I think this question is very fascinating because, if we understand the kind of like, put this into kind of like political situation in post-modern China, they were actually reflecting on the consequences of cultural revolution. So they were understanding cultural revolution as kind of like, remaining effects of feudalism in China. So this is kind of like, implied political inquiry in their question, right? So when they come to this system, they confess that, the inspiration comes from, Lars Ashby's design for the brain, which is, so what they take from Ashby is that, Ashby argues that, a system, whether it's biological, non-biological, they always try to adjust itself in accordance to the changes in the environment. So that the fluctuations of the system can be restricted with certain limits in order to maintain stability. So I think what attracted to Jing and Liu, Jing Guanhao and Liu Qingfeng, the two authors, is exactly the reason how Ashby explained the survival of this system. They use that to to explain why Chinese society as a system retains this such extreme stability, right? So I think it's very interesting moment to a very interesting moment to think about how this this notion of system theory was appropriated and also kind of developed in that context to explain certain social phenomena in China.
Mm-hmm. And positioned also to then try and be part of the movement calling for a way to break out of this and to embrace this notion of modernization, if I'm reading it correctly, yeah?
Yes, yes. As I was saying, this was closely connected to the kind of the notion of modernization, the notion of modern, right? Of course, it is also has to do with that global dissemination of modernization theory, in a Cold War period. So I think in that sense, the modernization is, the notion of modern is very important here to their investigation. Yeah.
Great, thank you. So I'm going to jump back a little bit to the first chapter, which is titled Extrasensory Powers, Magic Waves, and Information Explosion. So can you talk a little bit about... There's a lot in this chapter, as there is in all of the chapters. You get into human-machine environment, system engineering, but this really interesting connection. You talked early in the interview of this provocative image of these Qigong practitioners with pots on their heads. Can you talk a bit about the relationship, a bit about the Qigong craze, and the relationship between this idea of magic waves and the notions of information, and tell us a little bit about how information and magic psychic waves are sort of tied together in the discourse at this time.
Yeah, sure. While this Qigong fever, of course, it is spread across different social strata and involves different social agents at that moment, but there's an important figure in this scenario that is the scientist called Qian Xuesong.
Sorry, maybe we should just tell folks who aren't familiar just a little bit about a definition of Qigong and as a practice.
Well, it is kind of like traditional meditative practice, rooted in Chinese religious practice. The Qi is kind of like very nebulous term, right? So the Qi is supposed to carry the vital energy. Sometimes it's translated as vital energy, right? So I think in the context of the Qigong fever here, what is fascinating here is the Chinese scientists, including the Qian Xuesong I just mentioned, they actually argue that the Qi as kind of like, mode of information transmission. So this person, Qian Xuesong, who is a famous cybernetist, he actually studied a field called somatic science. He advocated that the study of the human body in terms of information processing and transmission. So the argument is that the way human body mobilize qi can be understood in terms of information processing and transmission. So he really wants people to look into qigong along with other phenomena such as extrasensory powers, such as traditional Chinese medicine, to uncover what he believes is a secret mechanism of information transmission and processing of the human body. So in this sense, probably by this kind of like imagination of the human body, there were a lot of like in popular culture, popular science literature, Constant these imageries or all these kind of like, you know, imaginations of sleep learning. So basically with a magic device connected to the human body, the person connected could be fed up with ceaseless information flows even when he's sleeping. So you can see, you know, this is a very interesting thing about this understanding of the human body is how it actually adumbrated the kind of like, you know, 24/7 temporality of connectiveness that even before the ubiquity of mobile and the wearable digital device that we have today. So I think, you know, the cybernetic logic of information moving across boundaries of human and non-human, moving across the human information environment is, you know, apparent in this discussion, the imagination from 1980s. So I think it's very interesting, you can say, prehistory to our current, ubiquity connection that we have today.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the idea of connectedness and connecting across those barriers, as you say, and that the chi is in, you know, is all of the different waves and signals that are in this information environment, that if we can find the right interface, we can just, those things can flow through us, right? And that, you know, it goes back to also, I think, Catherine Hale's talking about the, you know, when, as information loses its body and is able to flow, no matter what the sort of material substrate is for that information, it's able to flow. And that the craze really took off and accelerated at quite a pace and then fell out of favor, yes?
Yes. Fell out of favor mainly in 1990s with Fa Ren Gong, right? The whole Qi Gong became kind of like, you know, quiet down. But it also kind of like, you know, it was actually quite controversial even at that moment. Because, you know, Chen Shuizhen, these people, they advocated as kind of like information science, but they were also kind of like, you know, critical voice arguing this is kind of pseudoscience, right? You know, why looking into this phenomenon, this kind of an extrasensory powers, you know, so to some people, this is just ridiculous. But I think it is very simple, very interesting, but also very symptomatic for a moment, for that moment in China, because as I explained in the chapter, I think it's quite driven by the, you know, the kind of like desire of entering information society and also anxiety of facing this information revolution at the moment. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's fascinating to see during the period of somatic science how seriously these extrasensory phenomena were taken and given a kind of scientific legitimacy for a period where they were explored before eventually falling out of favor. But to see the degree to which it was taken up quite seriously in scientific circles is really amazing to discover.
Mm-hmm.
In the next chapter, which you call The Curious Case of a Robot Doctor, which is lovely, referring to some of the great Chinese literature that you take us through, some amazing stories, and the literary the literary and film analysis in this book is also, I mean, this is a book for film cultural scholars, media studies people, as well as cyberneticians and systems theorists. It really is the kind of transdisciplinary work I think we need a lot more of. You start to talk about the interface, rethinking labor, and the notion of the expert system, the development and deployment of something called expert systems, which are not only limited to China, of course, there's different forms of them. But can you tell us a little bit about this chapter and what types of innovations were going on around interfaces and expert systems?
Right. So expert system is an early generation of AI. Right. So as you just mentioned, it is not limited in China. It actually first was raised and developed in 1960s by Edward Feigenbaum, who is a computer scientist at Stanford University. So according to Feigenbaum, you know, the goal of an expert system is to actually write a program that can achieve a high-level performance that can be used to solve certain problems. So why expert, this notion of expert is actually developed opposed to another type of early AI, that is the general problem solver, right? So early in his career, Feigenbaum was actually involved in developing the general problem solver. The shift from the general problem solver to expert system reflect or arise from the kind of an impasse that AI research encountered at the moment. That was how to program, how to write common sense into a computer, right? So, you know, as a way to circumvent this question, you know, in order to, you know, circumvent the question of find out symbolic representation of the full range of human intelligent behavior, Feigenbaum proposed to retreat to the micro roles of isolated domains, of isolated areas, so that, you know, the computer, the program can focus on this rather restrictive area to solve a certain problem. It achieved limited scope success, but also there are a lot of issues arising from real practice. Because when we think about in reality, in practice, in order to solve a problem, the narrow domain of specialized knowledge often comes kind of short. They are far from sufficient. So hence, there are a lot of issues arise in real practice. So I think, you know, this is actually a very very interesting instance, you know, from the early generation of AI for us to reflect on, you know, what is AI, given that, you know, AI at our time, you know, has attracted so much attention, right? So, you know, what is the nature of human machine interface, right? So interface, you know, was often understood as kind of built-in feature of machines. We always say user-friendly interface. You know, that's a way to say, you know, if you design the, you know, the machines and the certain features in certain ways, you can achieve certain kind of similes, you know, friction-free interface using experience, right? But I think this understanding actually obscures the kind of the politics of the distribution of labor, knowledge, reproduction that is involved in the human-machine interactions, human-machine relations, right? So I think in this sense, the discussion, you know, about the politics of labor and knowledge production from the 1980s China provide a good occasion to examine this problem. So in the book, I use, you know, a kind of an intellectual discussion around, knowledge, politics of knowledge production, because this is a moment, as I just mentioned, the post-Mao politics just shift from class politics to a more economic, you know, centered scheme there. So accordingly, there's also a shift in the mode of knowledge production from Mao's time to the Deng Xiaoping's time, right? So I think it's a very, you know, good occasion to engage with the kind of like intellectual discussion, you know, about knowledge production, about labor politics, along with these imaginations, along with this development of an expert system in China. So in this way, I think it provides a picture for us to understand the politics of human-machine interface instead of just thinking about it just in terms of technical terms, right? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, great. Thank you. In the fourth chapter, we'll just jump over. We've talked about the ultra-stable system already a little bit, so I want to jump to the fourth chapter where we get into the rise of advertising in post-socialist China, and very fascinating for me, not knowing a lot about the inner workings of modern China to even, you know, address the role that advertising plays in such a society. So a lot of you know, really sort of enlightening material for me to encounter. And so you talk about effective form, advertising, information aesthetics, and experimental writing in the market economy. So can you talk a little bit about the sort of contested space of advertising? Because it's quite some very active debates inside, how it evolves as it first becomes, you know, more increasingly deployed. I mean, it seemed there was always some form of advertising going on, but it morphs quite a bit. And I'm really interested in this notion of, you know, the science of advertising that's going on. And of course, advertising has been scientized all over the world. It's, again, not unique to China. But this notion of this wonderful phrase, sticky fractions, and how advertisers and people thinking about advertising are thinking about this notion of sticky fractions, to me is a nice example of the kind of analysis that's going on into information flows. And as you, what you call effective form, right? Where, you know, as China is and moves into this post-socialist phase, we're actually trying to stimulate consumer behavior in a way that in the so-called West is quite familiar to us, right?
Right. Exactly. Yeah. I guess I think you're quite right. You know, the really important thing here is that as China started these economic reforms and with these budding market economy, the real question is how to stimulate in like consumerist design, right? So this was not quite a question in socialist China. There was, you know, limited amount of advertising, if you can call that advertising, in 1950s. But the kind of like, you know, advertising for commercial products basically disappeared during the Cultural Revolution that took place, you know, between 1966 to 1976. So when the economic reform starts, the first question, of course, is, you know, otherwise advertising may come back, right? So there are a lot of discussion at that time to justify why advertising was still necessary, was still possible in the socialist country like China, right? Because at that time, you know, China was still claims itself as a socialist country, right? So how to make compatible, you know, socialist ideology and advertising in China become, you know, very important there. So of course, you know, and again, you know, information theory, information played an important role. And this time, you know, information was argued as an important element, an important component for the operation of the socialist market, right? So because market economy really needs the flows of information in order to operate. So in that sense, that's one of the important arguments for people to justify the existence of or the return of advertising in post-Mao 1980s China. And then, you know, of course, you know, Chinese universities started to have this new program called Advertising Studies. As you mentioned, the Advertising Studies was not quite like unique, was not kind of like, you know, was not just limited to China. You actually, you know, a lot of like marketing studies in the West, you know, since the 1960s. So, you know, advertising study in China actually borrowed a lot of methods, a lot of terms from these marketing studies from West since the 1960s. And the important question, as you just mentioned, like the sticky fraction. Sticky fraction is a term one of the Chinese scholars mentioned, that is that, you know, the idea is that people, everyone, are surrounded by all sorts of information every day. You know, the purpose of advertising is to give people the information you need them to remember, right? So you give them the information, you want them to remember the crucial information about the commodity you advertise. So the sticky fraction is a way to manipulate people's reception of information, right? I think this is a very interesting to think about, you know, in relation to the kind of like, you know, literature, also experimental literature at that time in China, with the increasing media surrounded environment, with all sorts of like, you know, television, radio, you know, of course, with infused with commercials as well. So how to write in this kind of like, you know, environment full of, you can say information, but it can also say full of noises, right? So there's a kind of like very central question to a lot of writers at that moment dealing with this new environment. Of course, you can see, you know, Western modernist literature, and already, you know, a lot of scholars of Western modernist literature already started with this kind of like investigation into, you know, the relationship between modernist writing and the media. I think it's very important here is actually to understand the politics of form. I use the, you know, affective form, because form is really kind of like political challenging the term in post-socialist China. Because in socialist culture, the form was regarded as kind of like, you know, remnants of bourgeois capitalist culture. You know, the form is kind of like as kind of bourgeois culture, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And then the form, you know, it's the tension to form in 1980s China is really kind of political challenging, politically motivated. People want to move away from a kind of like, you know, Mao dominated, Mao discourse, Mao style writing. So in this sense, it's very interesting to see the competing force. On one hand, it has these ambitions of writers, intellectuals to reinvent the form of literature. On the other hand, you have all these ideas of writing in a new media environment. And the question is, you know, and then you have advertising study, which deals with how to, you know, use a form, use certain kind of, you know, advertising form to stimulate consumers, right? I think it's very interesting to see how all these kind of metaphors converge and negotiate with each other in that, you know, cultural space layer.
Mm-hmm. So, in speaking of form, your final full chapter before some concluding thoughts, you cinema is referred to throughout the book, but the final chapter does have some focus on sort of transformations in Chinese cinema. Mm-hmm. So, can you just summarize a few of the sort of main trends that you describe in the book as Chinese cinema responds to the circulation of these information fantasies and all of the various entailments that they bring?
Yeah, I guess I discussed this, of course, you know, in the last chapter, but also a little bit in the chapter related to ultra-stable system, right? So I think, you know, the development of Chinese cinema in the 1980s was actually quite fascinating and very complicated as well. I think to most film scholars, they may be familiar with the new wave cinema, exemplified by works such as Yellow Earth by Chen Kai-ge, right? So what is unfamiliar to a lot of, like, you know, film scholars, even to Chinese film scholars, is actually the rise of kind of the entertainment film or different type of films, like film experiments in the late 1980s, which is apart from the kind of like new wave cinema. You know, they were not regarded as so avant-garde in terms of technique, because they may be more aligned with the type of genre film, entertainment film, right? So I think it's very interesting, you know, even so, I think it's very interesting to think about, you know, how the kind of experiments in late 1980s actually emerged in response to the kind of like, you know, information environment that, in the 1980s, which I discussed in, you know, in early chapters of the book. So, you know, it is more in terms of understanding the nature of cinema in an information prevalent and multimedia environment, and, you know, how to understand the human image relation in a prevalent cybernetic setting. So I think this question, were quite like a lot of tension in the past decades in film studies, right? So people started to look at the cinema's relation to other media, and this is mostly propelled by the sense of crisis brought by digital. So I think in these concerns with of cinema in relation to other media actually not started with our time, with the digital age. It actually, if we take a look at 1980s China with this kind of discussion of cinematic imagery, how it's related to the kind of technology-enabled simulations or you know, simulated imageries related to the kind of proliferation of imageries and electronic imageries with the presence, increasing presence of television and the video cassettes and other types of media at that time. So in that sense, 1980s provide a very interesting occasion to think about this very theoretical and technical discussion, when in fact tied to the real politics concerning the competing interest from divergent agents between the kind of political power and party control and, you know, more market-oriented productions there. So I think, you know, in the last chapter I used the term liminal, so to refer the status of cinema at the moment, you know, this actually happens on multiple levels. On one level is the technical level, because cinema at the moment was challenged by other electronic media, by the budding digital technology. So the nature of cinematic imagery become kind of unstable at this moment, right? And then the second level is the socioeconomic level. You know, as I just mentioned, there's kind of like a shift from socialist state-sponsored production to more market-oriented production, right? And then on the third level is the, on the practical level, people started to reflect on the ethics of mediation per se. So, you know, in this sense, cinematic imagery is not only a representation of social reality, but also kind of produce and generate new relations and powers in that context. So I think that's kind of like, you know, key term that I want to engage in and return back to the very beginning of the book, that is the cooking pot, how cooking pot can become, you know, for us to understand the politics of mediation.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that circularity, of course, deeply cybernetic, that the nature of the description or the depiction, the distinctions we draw, then re-enters the thing that we're describing. And so it's an act of creation as opposed to simply an act of description. It's very important in second order cybernetics, of course. Well, thank you. We've taken up a lot of your time. You've been most generous with your time. It's a fascinating book. It's, you know, it just gives glimpses into places that have been unavailable, certainly to scholars like myself. You know, there's a fair amount written about cybernetics and its influence at the highest levels in say, the Soviet Union, but much less available about China. So this is a really eye-opening book for someone like myself. And it's so rich. It's so transdisciplinary. It really is a wonderful read. And I really do encourage our listeners to pick it up. We'll close with our usual concluding question, which is, what sorts of things are you working on now? Are you continuing in a similar vein or off in other directions?
You can see I'm really interested in the, you know, technology society interface question, right? So later this year I got this opportunity to work at the Center for Fourth Industrial Revolution at San Francisco as a fellow there. So one of the mission of this center is to work out the kind of like, you know, a set of like protocols, a set of like, you know, regulations, and solution, propose certain kind of solution to solve the certain issues raised by digital technology and AI. So I'm really excited with this opportunity because it provides the opportunity for me to understand the practical issues arising from this kind of like, you know, social technological interface, really from like, you know, everyday, you know, practice on the ground there. So I think it's a great way for me to align my research interest with this real social problem. So I'm really looking forward to this opportunity there. Yeah,
that's really exciting. At the most recent conference of the American Society for Cybernetics, there was much discussion about you know, being able to look into the social impacts of algorithms, and there's a lot of really excellent books. You know, Weapons of Mass Destruction. Destruction, another text that have come out recently. And so that's obviously really, really important work, and work that Norbert Wiener, you know, the founder of cybernetics, urged us to do even before he saw even the vastness of where these innovations would lead, that we take account of the social impacts. So this seems to be what you're describing, the work you're about to do, I think is really at the cutting edge of what's happening in these fields, and is obviously really, really urgent work to be done as we discover the ways that algorithms and search engines are exacerbating issues in terms of inequality, racism, etc. So that's really exciting that your expertise is going to be part of that effort. So we wish you all the best and look forward to the fruits of your work in that area.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. It's been a pleasure, and all the best to you.
It's a pleasure for mine. Yeah, okay. Thank you so much.
Thank you. You've been listening to New Books and Systems in Cybernetics, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. We'll talk to you soon.